Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey friends, welcome to another edition of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. And lots of things, good things happened this week. Today is Sunday, February, what day is today? 19th. And we had a bunch of finals. And well, not just today, but yesterday we had the Doha final, which is, by the way, while we are actually starting on. But before, let's say hi to Vansh. How are you doing, man?
Hey, Andre. Yeah, like you said, another really good week of tennis. You know, four pretty deserving winners from four different tournaments. Enjoyed catching quite a bit of them. And yeah, happy to start off with the action in Doha, which was yesterday for Iga, another win.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I forget. Like, I'm tired. I'm sorry. It's been kind of a long week for me. But anyways, like, well, I did catch a lot of the matches. I didn't actually watch the final at Doha. I just kind of essentially saw a bunch of the actually Pegula matches, but I didn't get to watch much of Świątek. And that wasn't actually much to watch.
Don't blame you, because her matches were so quick.
Yeah, exactly. I was about to say, I barely had any.
And you miss it. You know,
yeah.
That's kind of been the theme for Iga in Doha, because I mean, she spent 2 hours and 59 minutes on court. Granted, okay, she had a bye in the quarterfinals, but I mean, to go through Danielle Collins, 6-0, 6-1, yeah. Veronika Kudermetova, who's, you know, a player in like really good form, like who's, you know, been putting up some good wins like every single week. She's number 11 in the world. Yeah. And then obviously you have Pegula, who Pegula and Iga met four times last year in the final. Pegula herself had to save match points to get there. And that in and of itself was 69 minutes. So you add those all up, you have 2 hours, 59 minutes for six sets of tennis, and you have a bagel in each of the three. And I know that Collins didn't play very well in the first match. Like, that was more about Collins not being good, mm-hmm. than Iga being like super outstanding, I would say, the first one. But the last two, she really showed her class, yeah. above the whole field.
Yeah,
I feel like that was some seriously dominant stuff from her, yeah. Coming off the heels of losing in the fourth round of the Australian Open. And if you remember last year, this is where her win streak started, with a 37 match wins in Doha. And actually, you can even trace it back to the final she won over Kontaveit last year. That was 6-2, 6-0. So yeah. Four matches in a row she's played in Doha, and they've all had a bagel set. And like, they felt just as dominant as the score lines, you know?
Yeah.
She's winning some of these matches, just absolutely ruthless aggression. That serve that, you know, proved to be a very attackable in Australia in those conditions. You add, you know, wind to the equation. It was really, really windy in Doha. Gusts of wind all over the place. You know, her supreme control on her ground strokes is what really stood out to me, because obviously we know she has the topspin. But I feel like she has such a good idea about when to pull the trigger, when to go big on her forehand. She has such good, you know, I think what helps her in the wind, kind of like Rafael Nadal, I think she has such good footwork. So she's able to just, like, she never looks out of position. Like, even when she is, her shots have so much depth and margin that not only is she able to generate good racket head speed from, like, you know, not so great positions on the court, she's then so quick to get back to the center, because she stays so low when she's moving. And, like, I just think her balance and agility is so good. And then you add that with the fact that it's a slow to medium pace hard court. That's where I think she's almost done. That's where she really shows her class above the rest of the field, because I thought Pegula actually played a decent first set. She broke Iga twice. She was up a break, or not up a break, but she got one of the breaks back, and then like broke back again. Like, two of the games she won were breaks of serve.
Mm-hmm.
And Świątek just blew her away. Like, from 4-3, she wins the next eight games in a row. And you're just like, you know, Pegula, I thought, was a little bit like frustrated with the conditions, and like, you know, the wind was kind of like bothering her. Obviously, we know she hits the ball pretty flat, but she's very consistent herself. She doesn't miss much.
Yeah.
And then, but Iga was just next level, I thought, in that. Yeah. Second, there was no stopping her.
Yeah. I think it's what you do well in mentioning Nadal. Obviously, like, the comparisons are endless. Well, I think it's very clear that Iga molded a lot of her game around, like, what Rafa Nadal has played. Like, her forehand is pretty similar in a lot of ways. But I think that's one of the things that may or may not have come, like, unintentionally, like, to her as an advantage, is that Nadal is one of the masters of playing in wind. And I guess, like, it probably carried over into Iga's game without maybe even she realizing it. But, like, it's the timing that you must have, like, in those windy conditions, and the massive top spin that she can apply on her forehand. It just gives her a lot more margin to be playing those conditions. I'm sure she doesn't enjoy it. I don't think any player really likes to play in wind, because you really do have to be, like, a lot more careful, a lot more, just have to pay a lot more attention, be a lot more focused, and it's a lot easier to get frustrated. But the fact that she can dominate all the elements like that a lot more easily, like, just show it. I feel like one of the things that, as you said, like, she didn't really have like the best of times back in Australia. She didn't get as far as she would have gotten, as people would have expected her to get to. Like, a lot of people were saying that she was the favorite for the Australian Open. I was thinking that she might win it, although I did pick Sabalenka to win it, which was surprisingly good pick, honestly.
Yeah,
exactly. But I feel like it kind of, after you get back of a year like 2022 for Swiatek, like, you come over, like, to 2023, not necessarily the best of showings in the first Grand Slam of the year. I guess, like, doubts, at least in my mind, started to creep in. Like, how is 2023 going to go for Swiatek? Is it going to be dominant? Maybe not as dominant. We cannot really expect 37 wins in a row. if she does that is absolutely monumental. But I don't think this is going to happen. I think she's going to win. She's going to lose, rather, a lot sooner. But I think this week kind of, it's her first week back, I think, in on tour since Australia as well. It really did show me that I think she does still, like, really believe and doesn't necessarily feel the pressure. Or if she's feeling it, she's dealing it a lot better than, like, feeling the pressure as not only being the world number one, but coming off of the back of such an incredible year as 2022 was. So I think it's going to be business as usual for her this year. And if she loses, I think she's going to be able to deal with it, like, very well.
Yeah, and it has to be said that even though she didn't play her best in the Australian Open, like, Rybakina played one of the best matches. Like, you have to play tactically against her, which is really, like, just go after every single first serve that you know, that is spun in, because obviously we know that's not, like, the strength of her game, right? Particularly on a fast court. And Rybakina was just able to do that, like, relentlessly throughout the whole match. And she's obviously such a massive server herself. She's a clean ball striker if you don't get it out of her strike zone. And she's able to just, like, you know, even in that match, even though Iga was not necessarily having her timing from the baseline, she was winning most of the rallies that went over five shots. It's just that Rybakina dominated the 0-4 shot category.
Mm-hmm.
Like, way too much for Iga to really even, like, flip the script, even though she was 3-love up in the second set. And there were some chances, maybe, if she wins that second set. But I just think, and she was obviously feeling the pressure. Like, she had just lost to Pegula at the United Cup. A lot of people were talking about her. And I think this time of the season, she just feels so comfortable. Like, from Doha to the French Open, I feel like there's no one I can confidently say, like, who will be as more reliable. I don't, you know, it's quite possible she doesn't win all these six titles again, like she did last year. It's very, very, very hard to repeat something like that. But it's going to take a really, really supreme performance for someone to beat her, and she's just going to gain a lot of points. Like, I think enough to stay number one is what I think. Like, just, you know, she might not win Indian Wells and Miami, but I think she'll win probably at least one of them. I think she'll probably still win the French, if I were to predict right now. Mm-hmm. And probably in another clay tournament as well. Like, it's just the challenge for her is, I think, is always going to be Australia and Wimbledon, which she hasn't won yet. But I think Yeah, like it's a joke that she already has 12 titles and she's not even 22. Like she turns 22 in May.
Yeah.
She's already winning like these, she's winning a handful and she's still the dominant number one.
Yeah.
Like the points, you look at the points difference, it's still so big.
Yeah. I have a strong feeling that she will defend Indian Wells. I think the conditions are good for her, actually, because
like we were just talking about the control and the wind, like that's going to be a factor in Indian Wells. And you know, add the height bounce, you add all the variables.
Yeah.
I just think, and also because the attention, I feel like will be on so many other players as well. Like maybe less so on the WTA, but like, because it's a combined event.
Yeah.
And because you play every other day. We'll see how she handles that, because I remember last year, well, she kind of struggled in the first few rounds.
Yeah.
Like she had those tough matches against like Kerber, particularly Kerber. But like early on, she was losing the first sets. And then after that, she really picked it up from quarterfinals onwards.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. And next up, and it's funny that you mentioned her age. Like she's 21. She turns 22 in the 31st of May.
Yeah, so still like 3 months away, like during the French.
Yeah, I'm checking.
Just like Nadal.
Exactly. And the similarities are just too many. But it's like the one thing that I've been checking, her next tournament is Dubai.
Yeah, she will be the number one seed here. And it'll be fun to see Sabalenka back as well, because we'll see how she handles being a Grand Slam champion now.
Exactly. And that would be very interesting too.
I personally, you know, I would love to see a final between one and two. I think we're starting to see a lot more like you know, how like parity, we are still seeing like, you know, like 10 players can win tournaments and stuff like that. But I think if you look at the lineup here, in, for example, in Doha, like 7 of the top 8 seeds made the quarterfinals. That's, you know, that's pretty good reliability. Like, because you had so many of the top players playing. And then you even had like Sakkari and Pegula get to the semis.
Yeah.
Sakkari, another semifinal defeat. But even though it was to Pegula this time, it was a three-setter. She had some really good wins to get there.
Yeah.
But
And Świątek has a kind of a tricky round in her opener. She faces Leila Fernandez because she just won a match today, I believe. I still would say Świątek will get the best of her. But like last time that they played each other was like in January last year. A lot has happened since then.
Yeah.
It was in Adelaide. I'm excited to see what happens, but it's definitely tricky.
Did Leila have to qualify for this?
Not for this one in particular. Yeah.
Oh yeah, her ranking was high enough, right? So she
It's just because the draw is a lot.
Because last week she was having to play Pliskova in the final round.
That was nuts. But the thing is, like, this draw is a lot larger. I think it's a 64.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah, so
500s are so tough to get into.
Yeah,
It helps that it's a 64 draw. Yeah. I mean, like, there's some loaded matches even then in the first round. Like, you still have Andreescu and Rybakina, for example.
Yeah, it's the first round. That's ridiculous.
But yeah, like, I like also how, like, it'll finish on a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So then you don't have, like, you know, 4 or 5 finals on the same day at, like, the same time. So you can actually, I feel like the women get the spotlight properly on Saturday, because I think next week there's only 1 250 and there's Doha 1000. The 250 is in Mexico.
I guess like we'll have to wait and see. Like next week we'll be back about... today we won't be going over the full draw of Dubai, because like there's a few things that happened this week that we would want to get over. Maybe we might do a final preview or something. I think that'll be fun, especially if we get a Sabalenka Świątek. That would definitely would love to do like an extra episode of
the results of that 1000, and then also like it'll be a week before Indian Wells.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think I'm happy to switch over to the men now.
Yeah, totally. We had a few big things happening this week. Like, obviously, world number two Alcaraz is finally back on tour. I think he didn't play a single event this year, has he?
No, it's been over 3 months. Yeah. The last time we saw him was pull out of the Paris Masters quarterfinal with an abdominal injury against Holger Rune. He had to retire in the second set tiebreak, I believe it was.
Mm.
And then he was out for the rest of the year, so it was a shame he didn't get to play the ATP Finals, didn't get to play the Australian Open. We really missed him in Australia. That was, would have really added to the excitement, I think, had he been there. And then I think he missed Australia, but not with the injury that happened in Paris. It was another injury that he suffered in practice.
Yeah.
And he had like a leg or hamstring injury. And so now it looks like he's recovered from that. I love his decision to come back and play on the South American clay.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, imagine if he'd come back to Rotterdam, he would have had to play these top players, you know, so quickly and not really, you know, in conditions that he loves, like at this point in his career. So to come back in Rotterdam, to come back in Buenos Aires on the clay. And then, you know, I think he was able to experiment a little bit and work his way into the draw. Although I will say Laszlo Gera in the first round, I mean, that's not easy. That guy has some pedigree on clay. He's won Rio before. Mm. He has some big wins on that surface. So that he was able to navigate that match. That was three setters. But what stood out to me is that all of what made Alcaraz great is all still there. Like,
yes. You know,
that full package, that excitement that we love, that raw energy and that shot making and the speed.
Yeah.
I was looking, keeping an eye out for his footwork and speed and to see, like, you know, if he's able to bounce back from, you know, some ups and downs. And he was able to do that so, so nicely because obviously I mentioned the three setter that he had in the first match. He was able to win against Laszlo Gera, but then he played Dusan Lajovic in the next round. That was 6-4, 6-2. And that there were some really awesome drop shots and, you know, speed related retrievals. I noticed on his serve, I was looking out for his serve because I said the two things that Alcaraz probably I'll look out for this year is like how much bigger and more efficient does that first serve get? Because we know he has the speeds. Like he can hit 130. But is he going to improve the spot serving and the variation? And I think I noticed that he wasn't hitting as many kick serves this week. He was hitting more slice and flat serves.
Mm.
So that's, you know, and that's interesting because obviously on the clay, we know that kick serve, you know, is really effective.
He
can get over a player's shoulder, especially on the ad side. He can then dictate with a first ball forehand or backhand.
Yeah.
But in this, he was hitting a lot more flat, a lot more kick. He was mixing it up and he was still getting the high speeds. He hit like 137. He hit some 227 keys. He was getting some, even though he got broken and stuff, I like he was like experimenting. He was serving and volleying. He was like trying out different things. And I feel like he can do that in a field like this, even though like these are such good players. I feel like even when he's gets broken, he can always counter his return. He can and break back. And yeah, just another electrifying week for Alcaraz. And I was a little bit, I thought the Nori match would maybe go three sets. It would be tricky.
Yeah, so, it was tricky.
It was tricky because he was up 6-3, 5-2.
Yeah.
And then I think he felt the nerves a little bit of, like, this was his first time closing out a title since the US Open.
Yeah.
So he played kind of a nervy game to get broken. And then, like, you never want to allow Nori back into a match because, you know, he's really tough to beat, especially if you allow him another chance. And then Alcaraz was able to
close him out. Yeah. Yeah.
To close it out 7-5. So.
Yeah, I thought it was a great decision as well that he chose to go to South America. Of course, like he has points to defend in Rio, so that's already good that he chose to go down and just play on clay.
Yeah, and it's pretty much the same field in Rio as it was in Buenos Aires.
Yeah, exactly.
So just 500 points, but essentially the same players. You have Musetti, Schwartzman, Nori.
Yeah,
it's all the same.
Seats. Yeah. And I think it's pretty good as well because, like, I feel like the atmosphere was really good for Alcaraz as well. Like, just playing like in a Spanish speaking country, a lot of fans around. Like, you can zero pressure essentially. Ridiculous. Yeah, it was so good.
People were literally lying on the floor to watch his practices outside of the.
I would have done that too.
And it's like I don't blame them. Like this, you might not get that chance again.
Yeah.
To go in because it's so packed, but. Yeah, you're so right about the reception. Like, he speaks Spanish. He just feels like so comfortable in that environment.
Yeah, you could see in his reaction sometimes. You're just like having so much fun to be back on court, and that was essentially like, as you said, like the energy was back. I love that he played drop shots as well. Like, I feel like it's almost like he never left. In a sense, like, of course, like he might have been a little rusty here and there. Like, I feel like the fact that he wasn't able to close the title right away, it was one of those, but like he wasn't necessarily mistiming his drop shots. He didn't really lose his touch. His accuracy on the forehand and the backhand were still pretty awesome. And the way that he came back to take the second set in the final and win against Nori was pretty phenomenal because you could see he was frustrated. And that, like, I remember like one of the things that he was saying like last year, like he's sort of like Dominic Thiem was that when he's frustrated and he's playing not as well. He starts just like whacking the ball and like wailing it like as hard as he can.
He's like team in that sense. That
exactly.
He starts going bigger when he gets tight.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you see some players, they get a little, most players actually get passive and they start rolling balls in and, you know, maybe hoping for their opponent to miss. He's not
We're going to talk about him like later on, but Fritz ended up doing that in the Derby Beach final today, I noticed. And back to Alcaraz, he just started like hitting big forehands, big backhands, big serves, and he's just kind of like pumping himself up, like just big vamos, like in on court. And you could see that it was so quick though, like, because it's so easy that for a player when they get frustrated, they just kind of let this go for like way too long. For him, it took him like two games or something like that, like, because it was pretty insane.
He shook that off pretty quickly because that could have gotten complicated, you know, if Nori holds there.
Yeah.
You go to a tiebreak. I mean, I remember their matches like last year. They had some good battles, these two. Nori actually beat him the last time they played in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
That was a 3-hour match, three sets. It was just before the US Open in the quarterfinals of Cincinnati. But they played in Indian Wells. They played in Madrid. They played in the first round of the US Open actually back in 21. And so they played each other like five times now. And their matches have been good. Like, it's a good contrast, I think.
Yeah.
For Carlos to really test himself. So now he plays Buenos Aires, and then he plays Acapulco the week after that. So it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, if he can keep this going in Rio. I think he's still the favorite to defend his title there.
Yeah.
Because essentially it's the same field, and I don't really see like who would really stop him.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, maybe if fatigue comes into play or you know, you never know. He can always throw in a poor set or two here and there, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, I do hope that, like, he's not, because, you know, like, he's just coming back from an injury break and whatnot, but I hope that he's his body can take like too many tournaments in succession, especially like he ends up winning, I guess, Rio. I'm not entirely sure, like, do you think he would play Acapulco? Do you think he drops out of one of those tournaments to try to like rest a bit? Do you think he's just young enough that his body just recovered?
Yeah, he might. Like, honestly, he could go either way. It depends on how Rio goes. Like, he could always like just do that last minute. I remember last year he won those epic matches in Madrid against Nadal, Djokovic, Zverev, and then after that we all thought he was going to Rome. He was in the draw, and then he just decided to play it safe, pulled out.
Yeah,
and he was dealing with a niggle or two, and I think he wouldn't want to mess with that because he has so many points to defend in New Orleans, Miami.
Yeah.
And that extra week could actually help, because if you notice this week, like, there's not much time between Dubai, Acapulco, and Indian Wells.
No,
it's just literally the week after. Whereas I remember last year they had, like, that week was Davis Cup week, like, in the middle. But this year, like, the Davis Cup week was, like, the week after AO, so everything's, like, a week later.
Yeah.
But I think, like honestly, hopefully they've usually been making the right decision so far scheduling-wise. Like last year he didn't play any turnips before the Australian Open. He didn't play Rome before the French. And he came back on the clay, and I remember everyone, you know, we started to worry a little bit when he lost those two finals to Sinner and Musetti on the clay. And then he didn't like perform as well as we would have wanted in the hard court Masters, but then he won the US Open. And then it's like, okay, yeah, that's what matters. And he won that. And then, so no, he's a great asset to this game. Honestly, he is so, so exciting and brings a lot of casual fans, and like I think the ratings and everything, like the next 10 years as far as like the sport is concerned, and like just how marketable he is, and just, you know, like I like that he's cocky in a good way. Like, it doesn't come across as arrogant at all. Like,
no, yeah,
like he knows how good he is, and he is at the same time respectful of all his peers.
Yeah, so it's just like the vibe that he gives is that he's enjoying a lot playing tennis.
Yeah, playing, like, you can see him just smiling at his team and just like his box. I noticed Juan Carlos Ferrer was not in the box
this
whole week. But like, he still had his agent there. He still has a pretty big team, his physio and everyone there. So it's all good vibes for the Carlitos.
Oh gosh, so good. That's what tennis needs. Breakpoint season 2, please bring in Alcaraz.
I think he should be on there. If they're doing it, like, because Iga and him won the US Open, I think they'll do some filming. And hopefully, because you want to bring casuals into the game. Yeah,
these are the guys. Yeah.
You know, this is the guy. Like, I remember during the US Open, I had friends who didn't even watch tennis. You know, they saw Instagram posts and they followed the US Open page, and they were just sending me highlight videos of across hot shots. I was like, yo, they were like, yo, who is this guy? Like, you know, how is he hitting these, like the behind the back shot against Sinner?
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, the shots like that, like those.
And you reply to this friend's like, he's the future of tennis.
Yeah, like, and then, you know, now they know, like, he's the number one, or he was the number one.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just like, I just want to see him and Djokovic. That's what I want to see, a matchup between them two. Yeah. Hopefully more than once, because I think that's the rivalry that's going to be the most exciting out of all of them. Djokovic, Alcaraz, like the next 2-3 years.
Yeah.
Like that's going to be.
Yeah. Hopefully Djokovic doesn't have like a super quick decline due to age. I don't see that happening. Like, I don't feel like he gives vibes that this is happening to him, but you never really know. The guy's 36 years old now, so we'll see. I do
forget that, like, because a lot can change in like a year.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's easy to just sit here and be like, oh yeah, he's gonna win 25 plus.
Yeah,
you just never know, because I remember even when Federer won 2018 Australian Open, you know, it looked like, you know, he was gonna win more, or at least one or two more, and maybe even Wimbledon. But then, like, after the Wimbledon final in 2019, it just, you know, his knee just stopped cooperating, and it was over pretty fast. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I just appreciate everything while it's there.
And I'm hoping that this year we can get like a few good, like, Alcaraz Djokovic matches. Do you think he plays? Because I think Djokovic is struggling to get in the US still.
So. Yeah, I highly doubt he's going to be able to get into the Indian Wells in Miami. I thought he was looking for an exemption.
Yeah.
And there's like some announcement on Twitter from an unofficial source, hasn't been confirmed, that you know, he's scheduled to hold a press conference. So we'll see what that's about. I don't really know. You know, we'll see. But as it stands, yeah, he can't get into the country in Miami, so he'll probably play in Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
And we'll see him on the clay. And it looks like Nadal's probably not gonna play the Sunshine Swing.
Yeah, exactly, as well. Hopefully Nadal plays Monte Carlo. He's fit enough to get there, and who knows, maybe he can get like another solid like semi-final lineup if like all of three of them get to that stage, if Alcaraz decides to play Monte Carlo, of course. Yes. But
yeah, we'll see. I mean, Nadal hasn't dropped out of the top 10 since April of 2005, and I think that's in danger of now being streak is in danger of being broken if he doesn't play Indian Wells Miami. But yeah, like, you know, you hope like he just gets back to form and he's healthy, so we can see like them all play together and then have a good play season. And, you know, maybe we'll see another Djokovic and Nadal at the French or somewhere. And hopefully it's not in the fourth round or something, because you hope it's like semifinal and not, you know.
Yeah. Although by the looks of it, it's kind of looking like a round four, but actually it would be more of a, it'll be around that.
But we'll see, because, you know, I there's a lot of retirement rumors and stuff swirling around Nadal. But for me, I just have to wait and see him on back on the clay, because, you know, even last year, he didn't have any match prep leading into the French Open, and look what happened.
Yeah, and honestly, I will only believe Nadal is retiring when he holds a press conference and says, I'm retiring for good this time. Yeah. Because all this time has been saying, like, maybe, but, like,
honestly, I think in press conferences, they should just stop asking these questions about retirement.
Yeah.
Like, ever been like, oh, yeah, you know, actually, now that you think about it, I'm going to retire, you know? Now that you mention it, you know, it's like they never do. Like, they always just dodge the question. They'll say the same thing. Like, I don't know, you know, I don't know when, like, my body will stop. As long as I have the passion, I'll keep playing.
Yeah. It's always the same thing. Like, especially, like, when it's, like, a Rafa Nadal, like, caliber player. Like, you're not just going to get him, like, to kind of, like, blow the secret out and just, like, in a press conference and then, like, a fourth round loss. Like, he's not going to sit up in there and just be like, yeah, actually, I was planning on a press conference to announce that he's not going to say that. It's going to be a grand thing. He's going to announce things. There's going to be plenty of journalists.
Like some kind of a tour, or maybe these players are so methodical about it's going to be interesting to see like how they decide to retire and whatnot, because like, you know, even like Roger, he was asked questions about it since 2007. Like, because back then it was like considered abnormal to play past 30.
Yeah, exactly.
And now that's been the big three are totally like.
Yeah, and that was mostly because of like players like Pete Sampras, who was he retired at 31, and Sampras other players and before then.
Mostly were like the two big champions that I can think of in the 90s.
And then we had like Agassi, like at 35, like
playing
good tennis, but he's like nowhere near. And people are just praising Agassi for playing that well at 35. Well, yeah, like you got Federer, Nadal, Djokovic at 37.
Nowadays, you have people peaking at 28, 29. So
yeah, Which is, speaking of, the next final that we were going to talk about before, you just went on a tangent just out of the blue. It was Medvedev-Sinner, pretty good final. Medvedev had a really, really good tournament, in my opinion.
Solid week.
Yeah, I was very scared that he was just going to bow out in like round one to Davidovich Fokina because his game was not clicking. Like he just, you know, like it can happen to a defensive player and a counterpuncher when, you know, they're just not moving as well. The shots are just not as penetrating. They cannot get as deep. And Davidovich Fokina just was happy enough to like just rip through his forehand and just like go for winners. But then I feel like when Medvedev really started clicking on his serve and on his defense, especially on the, well, really on both wings, really, I think that's when the match turned around. And I think that's when the week entirely turned around for Medvedev, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, you're right. Like, he started out kind of slow against Davidovich Fokina, and then he wins the next two sets, like, you know, pretty comfortably after, like, struggling to find his timing. But I just think, like, indoor conditions, slow, like, indoor hard courts, they're the best for Daniil, because he can just be the defensive wall that he likes to be from the back of the court. And then like when the opponent is least expecting it, he can be on that baseline and just inject pace in his forehands.
Yeah.
And then, or just because like on a faster court, you can kind of rush that wing. And if you have like a decent amount of variety, or you use the, you know, the serve out wide on the deuce, and like there's, you know, all those things that players have been doing to him the past 1 year, they're just not able to do that with the same reliability and consistency on this slow indoor hard court conditions where like Medvedev, it's low bouncing too. Like it's the perfect ideal conditions. I feel like for Medvedev, if you remember last October, he also won Vienna, and he kind of like he looked really good there too. Like he beat Dimitrov there. He beat Sinner. He beat Shapovalov in the final from a set down. So this week it kind of reminded me of that. He looked better, like more in his element, I feel like.
Yeah.
And also he just frustrates his opponents because he gets them into these long baseline exchanges.
Yeah.
Where like you have to be so precise to get the ball by him, and just hitting it hard and hitting with brute force and you know, being strong off of both wings is gonna give you progress, but it's not gonna win you points.
Yeah.
Because it'll just extend the rallies. And like even the match against Dimitrov, like most of the rallies were 7-8 shots. Match that Medvedev ended up winning 6-1, 6-2, but you just like unless you like you're just completely mixing it up, like you're serving and volleying, or you're just like you're having an out of mind day on your forehand or stuff like that, it takes a kind of some redlining tennis, I feel like, in these conditions. Because like Medvedev is just so comfortable. I think it was an important week for him though to beat, because he beat Felix, a top 10 player, like for the first time in over a year. His last top 10 win was against Tsitsipas, the Australian Open last year. And now he's back in the top 8. I feel like that's where he belongs. He was number 11 coming into this week. And then, like a nice win over Sinner, who also had a really good week. Sinner won last week in Montpellier.
Yeah.
And so this was his 8th match in, 9 days, I guess? Because he played 3 matches there, and then like this was his 5th match here. But I feel like, because I actually thought Sinner did really well in the first set when he won, because he was staying super patient in these rallies and not just, you know, pulling for the trigger early. Making mistakes. Like he was very smart about how he played tactically, and he was like really hanging with Medvedev, kind of beating him at his own game, like in those long baseline rallies.
Yeah, he was
they had rallies over 9 shots, and they had 32 rallies over 9 shots, and Sinner won 18 of those. So, you know, that's an important stat. But I think what that ended up doing is it took so much out of him physically.
That's true. Yeah.
The next 2 sets, he was just like, you know, you saw him a little bit like sort of hunched over after some points. Like he was just breathing heavily, like gasping for air. That's what I feel like Medvedev, he can do that. He can take your lungs away sometimes.
It really reminded me of when Medvedev played Rublev last year, the Australian Open, how they played like this 40 shot long rally that Rublev ended up winning. But then at the end of it was like nothing happened for Medvedev, and then Rublev was absolutely done. And
I felt like Sinner did do some good things, like in terms of mixing it up in the first set. He was 10 for 15 at the net. He hit some good drop shots. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. But he gave Medvedev kind of different looks. And I think, but that's not his natural game. I think that's the point, is like his natural game is still hit really big and clean off of both wings. And like, you know, like just a barrage of offense. But against Medvedev, you kind of have to, like, you can't just hit through him. You have to hit around him in a sense. Yeah. And you have to be fresh enough physically to do that, because otherwise you're pulling the trigger on the, like, it's a mental challenge.
Yeah, you kind of have to outfox Medvedev in a way.
Yeah.
Because like, it's a,
Because you're not going to outgrind him from the baseline.
Oh, yeah, no. That's not going to happen.
Unless you're Djokovic. And even Djokovic in his later years, he doesn't do that. Like, he'll serve in volley.
Yeah, and one of the things that I thought was cool about Medvedev was that, like, I've sort of noticing that, like, he's a lot more confident in his own game. Like, the way that he celebrated the title was pretty Medvedev-like. Like, this weird celebration that doesn't really mean anything, but
just kind of like a shake with the arms, right?
It's exactly.
Like a shrug. It's just like, I think he made that his thing, like, after 2019. He's like, I'm not going to celebrate any of my titles.
Yeah.
Because, like, that'll be my trait. Like,
which is awesome. It's definitely a trademark of him for sure. And I feel like his mental game is a lot better as well. Like, his problem solving is a lot better nowadays.
I have to give him credit for his problem solving in this match because I think last year he wasn't doing a great job of that. Like,
exactly. Same.
Like when he lost the first set, he was not good. Like, last year he was 4-for-11 in deciding set matches. Yeah. And the year before that, in 2021, he was 14-5. So that's a big gap. And then now he's won two this week from a set down. And I thought his tactics were pretty good. What I liked also is that in the beginning of the first set, he started playing more aggressive. If you notice, like, the first game of the second set, he actually had some big forehands, some, like, good angles, like, got center off the court, and he immediately got the break. And I think that just set the tone for the rest of the set, because now he's front running. He has a big serve.
Exactly.
And once he has the break, because he didn't have leads in the first set. Like, he was finding it coming back, and center was 4-1 up, and
I was actually really surprised. Like, he was, like, running around his backhand to hit, like, a pretty big forehand. I had to look twice to see if it wasn't Sinner hitting that chop. Like, he was actually Medvedev letting that out. And I was surprised that, like, he didn't really do that at all in the first set. And then he starts doing that. He did have a couple, like, runs towards the net as well. He started, like, moving around Sinner with his backhand a lot more as well, using that, like, famous, like, inside-out backhand that he has sometimes.
Yeah.
I definitely think that he kind of decided to make a change in his game, and it worked pretty well, aside even from the fact that he could still outgrind Sinner from the baseline. But he definitely gave Sinner a lot more to think about when he started doing, like, those tactical changes in his game.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, And so some of that mojo is back. It's almost like he lost that first set. It kind of freed him up a little bit, because he's like, yeah, you know, I could have lost that 6-2 or 6-3, but it was 7-5, and didn't really panic. And it's just it'll be interesting to see what he does, because as we know, this next part of the season, like, up until August, it's like, you know, like, as many points as he can gain is, like, the better for him, because, like, let's be honest, Indian Wells, like, I don't think those conditions suit him at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, like, high bouncing, very slow, like, ball goes fast through the air, but, like, he hits flat shots, and those are, you know, he's not going to get the same kind of penetration he would on a low bouncing, slow, like, indoor hard court, or any kind of other hard court besides Indian Wells. I actually think Miami might be a little better for him.
Yeah,
from a game style point of view, like, it's more close to a normal speed hard court.
Yeah, what was his result last year in Indian Wells? Quarterfinal.
Oh, in a quarterfinal in Miami. Indian Wells, he lost early. He lost to Monfils. It was like the second round.
Yeah,
second match. So yeah, he's not been past the fourth round of Indian Wells, and he's made quarterfinals the last 2 years in Miami. And yeah, this was a time, like, last year he was number one, and then he had the hernia operation after Miami. And then, like, he didn't play anything until the French, or Geneva, and then the French on the clay. But next week he's playing Doha and then Dubai. So it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, he plays 3 weeks in a row and, you know, this might be good for him because now he's trying to get his ranking back up. And
Kind of needs to before the clay season for sure. I do think that he might, because he reached the quarterfinals 2 years ago at the French, think that he might find a little bit more joy in clay in the next few, especially because he has a lot less pressure on his shoulders. He's just trying to get back up. So I think he might be able to play better or not. I don't know. We'll see.
I think so. I like it when he's the underdog for him. Like, you know, when he was number one and he just lost that final, it just didn't really like feel right. You know, he was number one, but he didn't really like, he wasn't playing like it. Like he had the hernia thing. Like then he wasn't able to play Wimbledon. And then, you know, he still had that lingering defeat to Nadal, which like he never got through. But now I think the fact that Australia is done, like now that he's like the full 1 year cycle has been complete and he got that out of the way.
Yeah.
Like, now, like people aren't really talking about him as a contender.
Yeah.
Even like this week, I feel like even me, like I'm being really cautious in terms of like it was one really good week,
mm-hmm.
but I still want to see him do this in a Masters 1000 and in a major, particularly the ones where he's normally won. And then I can be like, okay, yeah, Medvedev is like, he's back to 2021 level.
Yeah. We'll see by the time that he gets like maybe top three or five, if he can get there. So we'll see if he can pull that off. And I think Sinner, I'm still sort of, how do you feel about Sinner? Do you think he's going to be back into the top 10 this year? Do you think he's going to be able to make it to Turin?
Yeah. I feel like he'll be in the top 10 this year. I think he's improving, even though the ranking, like he was at 17 at one point. Now I think he's 12,
mm-hmm.
but also more than just the ranking. I think he's like, he got his first top five win in a long time over Tsitsipas. That was a big win for him to shake off the Australian Open match, 5-set loss. And also the way he did it, it was very confident and imposing. He like dominated Tsitsipas mostly in that match. And then now he does well indoor hard court. He won the title last week. Made the final this week. He's probably a favorite to win the title next week as well. If he's physically, I worried about him a little bit physically. And I think he's missing like physically, like, you know, can his fitness hold up? Because we've seen him get a little bit of niggles and injuries that like, these are kind of like minor injuries, but then they cost him like for the match or like for like 2 or 3 weeks after that.
Yeah.
So I wonder if he can keep that up, like just get a little stronger in the legs, like keep working on the variety, because I feel like, actually, like if I compare him to Rublev, I think he's more comfortable at the net than Rublev is. Like, he's like, he just doesn't trust himself to do it enough in big moments yet. But I feel like when he's up there, like he feels comfortable up there. Like he has options in his game. It's just now like mixing them up against top five level opposition in the big moments and doing it consistently without having a physical dip. I feel like that's the next step, is like no more physical dips.
Yeah,
and like let's close out some of these wins.
Yeah,
because like, you know, obviously we know last year the last three majors was like 6-3 in the fifth against Alcaraz, Tsitsipas, and Djokovic. So that shows that he's on the corner of flipping some of these head to heads.
Yeah,
that win was big.
Yeah, I do feel like there's like he's getting really close, and that's like when it starts to get like sort of like, you know, how Felix got super close 8 times to finals and never really could close it up. You start thinking about the scar tissue and like how is it going to overcome those mentally. I just feel like in a way, like Felix, he sort of needs a big breakthrough win in a way that he's sort of like you're saying, like just flipping up like one of those like big matches that he can. He can win in a big tournament as well.
It's the same
thing
actually for Felix, like against the Medvedev, in the Medvedev matchup, because like he also had a match point against him last year.
Yeah,
and he's played him tight a couple of other times, but this one, like, it was just perfect conditions for Daniil in the quarterfinals. And I saw Felix trying to serve and volley a lot, just to overcompensate for, you know, the lack of baseline rallies. He's inevitably going to win the long ones against Medvedev, especially.
But Felix didn't play his best though. Like there was a little set for him.
It was not a great performance. Made a lot more unforced errors. Like just wasn't patient enough.
Yeah, and his first serve was really low in terms of percentage.
The first serve percentage was 49% for the whole match. So that's definitely not going to cut it. And he was defending his title, so that's always.
It might have gotten to him a bit. Yeah.
But Yeah, because last year he also made the Marseille final, but now he's playing in Doha this week.
Yeah, I think it's my guess is that he wants to maybe. I don't know if he's playing Dubai, but like he might be looking for, and I might be saying like just garbage right now, but like I don't know if he's looking for something that's more similar to Indian Wells so that he can finally do well in there. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, yeah, I feel like Marseille doesn't necessarily make much of a difference, and maybe just trying to find like, well, I guess Marseille's competition is pretty high as well, but like I don't know, like maybe Doha just pays more money, which is also a possibility. Yeah. So
yeah, you never know. Like it's sometimes it's appearance fees. It's like you agree like early on to play these events, like
yeah,
like you get a contract or something. Or
yeah, plus it's also 250, so he would, yeah, if he makes the final, he'll be defending the same point. So
yeah. Yeah. Maybe, yeah. I mean, yeah. But any other takeaways from Rotterdam? I thought Talon Griekspoor, he's had a good start to the year.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember we were talking about him in this podcast in 2021 at the end of the year with Damien.
Yeah.
Because he had won like 6 challenger titles.
And yeah.
He's had a good start to the year. He won a 250 in Pune in India. And then I think he made the third round of the Australian Open, lost to Tsitsipas. And then he's now made the semis here, and he beat Zverev along the way, which is a good win.
Yeah.
And then he played a tight match against Sinner in the semis, like a respectable 7-5, 7-6.
Yeah, it's true.
And he was 95 before Pune. Now he's 40. So I think he's like number 9 or 10 in the race too.
Yeah, that bodes pretty well for him, because he probably wants to push his ranking to be seeded at the French Open.
If he gets seeded,
yeah. So
something, you know, because we're seeing more guys kind of break through at his age, winning like from the Challenger Tour, but like transferring it onto the main tour and being in the top 50.
How old is he now?
Like 26.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, like I saw him playing once in a Davis Cup tie, and he's one of those guys that just hits pretty big. So
yeah,
you can never really go that wrong with that. Like it's normally going to win you a lot of matches at the like 250s and even like 500s, like he did. So yeah, I think that'll be interesting to see. Like, it'll be one of those opponents that you don't really want to draw, like if you're starting slow. So yeah, or if you're like a first round.
Worried about a little bit concerned about Runa.
Yeah, that's mostly physically, isn't it?
Because physically, yeah. And because he was slated to play so many tournaments in a row, like after Davis Cup, then he was playing Montpellier, Rune, and he was going to play every week until Indian Wells. But then I saw like he just didn't look quite right. And then he had a wrist injury, and then he had to retire.
Yeah.
In the middle of his match. And actually, I think the wrist injury is like when he hurt it at the Australian Open, when he fell against Hugo Humbert, like he hurt his ankle and then he fell on his wrist.
Oh.
But it was still like good enough to like, you know, play and like recover. Like he still played in a five-setter with Rublev, and then he played like last week, got to the semis and lost to Cressy, and then this week. But now he's pulled out of Montpellier. So we'll see. I hope he's not like just rushing into things and
yeah,
you know, just but we still have to see with him like do it into the outdoors. It's like the recency bias thing, because he won Paris and he won, got to the finals of Basel, and like had a good run at the end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we sort of like the February and October months are kind of interesting, because it's like data gathering, and it's also like is it foreshadowing another big run for some of these players, you know, in the slams or in the big events, or is it just more like, you know, this is where they do really well, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. And wrist injuries are just really terrible. Like you can see, like in Del Potro.
You don't want to mess up with the wrist. Like if it's hurting one bit, I feel like maybe that's why I was more concerned. Actually, it was the wrist, because you know we've seen what happened with Thiem and Del Potro, and
yeah, those are terrible. So yeah, and then just moving on.
Thiem is playing again this week. Actually,
yeah, he did. So, Wait, but he also played this weekend. Where did he play? Is it Rotterdam that he was playing at?
No, he played this week in Buenos Aires.
Oh yeah, it's true.
He beat Alex Molchan in the first round, which I thought was a good win, and then he lost to Juan Pablo Varillas.
Who actually reached the semifinals, isn't it?
Yeah, he had a very good week, because he beat Musetti, which I didn't expect, and then he like pushed Nori decently tight for two sets.
Yeah, so yeah, it was a... All in all, it was in hindsight, not a bad loss, especially for
But now I think now he's playing Montero in the first round of Rio, and then if he wins that, then he plays Nori. So
well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Yeah. Like two lefties in a row, I guess, would be kind of a good a good training.
We'll see, because I was so much positive about him at the end of last year when he like lost to Korda in Antwerp and he beat Hurkacz. Had some good wins, like from post Wimbledon clay till Vienna, and then he shut it down for the year. After Vienna, I thought, okay, good. He'll have a 2-3 month off season, and he can work his way back.
Yeah.
In the rankings, but this year like hasn't got any wins, like apart from the first round and against Molchan, he hasn't been able to win sets. Like, and the Australian Open, I feel like that was the worst opponent he could have got, Rublev, in the first round.
Yeah.
That's because it's already like a kind of a tough matchup for him, and he's still trying to work his way back in the first round. And then like he lost both his matches at the Davis Cup in Croatia, the tie there, and then the loss on the clay these last couple of weeks. But
yeah, we'll see. Hopefully he can get like to at least like a good level that he's winning some matches. Like I think in a way, like even like Murray is right now, sort of like is able to like make some deep runs, and sometimes you can still expect good matches out of him. But like the way that he is right now, it's I don't know. It's almost like thinking, shouldn't you be playing like a couple more challengers here and there just to try it out? But like I don't know. Yeah,
maybe. Yeah, I feel like it'll be kind of the same. Like the South American challengers and the 250 challengers are like not that much difference, I feel like, now.
Yeah,
in terms of the caliber of players that he is going to face, just has to like back up the wins, and
that's
there's
true.
No really like substitute, I feel like, at this point. A little bit like Stan, but Stan is just a lot older and is kind of like one big last push, because he also made the quarterfinals in Rotterdam, and he's like kind of in the similar ranking, like around 100.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Murray. He's playing this week as well in Doha. I think he's playing Sonego in the first round. If he wins that, he'll play Zverev, I think, and that's what I saw in the draw. So
that's a pretty bad draw.
Yeah. But you know, it's winnable. I think if he continues the form that he had in Australia and doesn't spend too much energy in his first round. That's what we always kind of go back to that with Andy. It's like,
can you not play an epic match in the first round?
Like, can you not go 3.5 hours, please?
Yeah.
So you have enough left in the tank.
Which, by the way, is more than capable of going 3.5 hours in three sets. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But we should talk. The last thing we should talk about was Delray Beach. Fritz winning another title. This is his fifth title now. And he beat Mackenzie McDonald in the semis, and he beat Miomir Kecmanovic in the final today.
I
actually watched Kecmanovic and Fritz last year live with my dad at Indian Wells. That was a quarterfinal match, and then they played again the following week, and Kecmanovic beat him. And then Kecmanovic played this epic with Alcaraz, and this is kind of when Kecmanovic was like peaking last year.
Yeah,
like from Australian Open to Indian Wells in Miami. But Fritz, I thought, was the favorite and was likely going to win this title. He had some blips and didn't like always play his best. Like, you probably watched the match against Manarino a little bit.
Yeah.
And that was a bit tricky. But he comes through in these tie breaks. I think that's a big takeaway this year. He's 11-1 in tie breaks this year. And just the one loss that he had was to Popperin in the second set after winning the first set in tie break. That was the only tie break that he lost. And ended up like kind of costing him the match against Alexei Popperin. Because I kind of think if he beats Popperin in that Australian Open, with the way that draw was, like, you know, I thought he was going to make the semifinals, honestly, there. So probably the next step for Fritz is start, you know, doing better in these majors and avoid these losses like to Brandon Holt in the first round of the US Open and then second round of Australian Open, Alexei Popper. And like, on paper, these aren't good losses. Like,
you
know, they might have been playing really well and peaking that day. And like, Popperin is one of those players, and he played out of his mind, to be fair. But Fritz, the kind of caliber of a player he is now, he should now. I think people expect him like to go deep and win these type of matches.
Yeah,
but this is good. Like, he's won his fifth title here, and he's still doing decent aside from that loss. And then I think the other takeaway is like, now he's number five in the world, starting February 27th. So that's mostly because like what I was saying earlier, like the Acapulco points for Nadal are coming off, and Rublev won Dubai. last year. So those two are coming off a week earlier.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, it's not a guarantee that he'll be number five going into Indian Wells, because he still has to perform in Acapulco and in that February 27th week. Mm. And it kind of depends on how Rublev does in Dubai as well.
Yeah.
But if he's seeded fifth and Djokovic is not allowed to play the Indian Wells of Miami, then that means he'll be seeded fourth. So that fourth seeding is always, you know, a big thing when you're trying to, just for the seedings, because we know how that works.
Yeah. But it'd be good for him to defend his title as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he really likes, and he's not like, you know, like a proven defender of titles or anything like that. It wouldn't shock anyone if he didn't defend it or he lost early with an Indian Wells. But I also wouldn't be surprised if he gives up a decent showing and he makes the quarter semis or something like that, because the last two editions, like, all of his biggest wins have come at Indian Wells. Like, the last two editions, he's beaten Nadal, Rublev, Sinner, Berrettini, Zverev, some really good wins. And and obviously he won the whole thing last year.
Yeah, I was really I thought he had a really good showing in Daria Beach. He was definitely the favorite to win it all.
Because last week he was also the favorite, but then we had the nice Wu Yibing story, and
that was way out of the ordinary. Like, that was something that you cannot predict. But yeah, not that you essentially you should be able you can't really predict anything, but I guess like 99% of the
time. Mike Cation, by the way, because Mike Cation predicted it before the tournament even started.
Wow.
Which, like,
that he was going to win? Knows.
Yeah, that he was going to win Delray Beach. Like, when the draw came out, he saw the draw and he saw, okay, Chapo is there. Like, he likes that matchup against Chapo. And then he was like, okay, Wu Yibing is winning this whole thing. And he actually got it right. So,
wow. Yeah. Props to him. Like, probably the only person who predicted it, and that was probably with confidence.
It on air too, which is like even bigger, because he was calling one of the challenger matches on air. Like, Wu Yibing, I think he's going to win the title that week. And it's like, it actually happened. So,
wow, that's nuts. Yeah. Especially with Fritz in it. Like, Fritz is an experienced player who's won a Masters 1000. So, I think that one of the things that was surprising about Fritz is how he shows himself in the court. Like, it was very mature. Like, he was very aware of the fact that he was the favorite, and he was playing like the favorite for the title. Like, the way that he played against Mannarino, he was defending really well. He took his chances. Like, he didn't miss his opportunities. I think he got broken towards the end of the second set. He dropped one of his breaks, but he had like a double break, so he ended up like closing out the match, I believe 6-4 or something like that. But
which match was this? Was this the Mannarino
one? Yeah.
So
he was playing really well, but like I only could catch the highlights on Tennis TV about on Taylor Fritz and Kecmanovic. And I think that match was entirely on Fritz's racket, to be fair, because the forehand was definitely the biggest short on court. His serve was a lot better. His return was really good. His backhand was able to keep up with Kecmanovic. Kecmanovic is still a little bit better, especially when he goes to like that down the line shot. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, I think the only reason that he lost the second set, well, Kecmanovic did play really well, but I think Fritz kind of slowed down a bit. So like, he was too happy to just trade and not really take take control of the rallies.
He probably got a little bit passive as he was
closing
out the title. Maybe felt the pressure a little bit.
Yeah, probably. So like, I feel like that kind of really opened up the door for Kecmanovic to play his best tennis, just start like dictating in the rallies. And that's when it slipped up like for the second set, but then he got control of it like right away. And I think that's really props to Fritz, because Kecmanovic is a good player, and it's problem solving, right? You kind of have to get back and just restart.
But I really like the self-belief that Fritz has. So I feel like he goes on the court against any player ranked 1 to 100 and he thinks he can win.
Yeah.
Like, that's the impression that I get. Like, he walks on that court against Nadal, Djokovic, anyone, he's like, I can win this match. And he plays, he backs himself, and he you know, he's not surprised by any of these results, like to win these titles. That, like, now he's been in 10 finals. He's won 5 of them. Like, he's been around for quite some time. He's 25. And I feel like this is his prime. So now the question is like just, yeah, like can he put together a really deep run in a major? And yeah. Can he like be one of those Americans that like gets into major finals? I mean, like, because now Tiafoe has done it, Paul has done it, and the most consistent one hasn't. Because his best result is a quarterfinal at Wimbledon. So, you know, let's see. I feel like Wimbledon and the US Open are good opportunities for him to prove himself.
Yeah.
Like on the biggest stage. Because, yeah, I mean, it's no secret. He's never going to be the best mover. Like, you look at the top 10. You know, he's not defensively, he's improved in that department, and his ball striking is so good that when he's on the front foot, he's excellent. But when he's pushed into corners and he's having to like, you know, defend, change directions, you know, those great things that like, for example, Medvedev, Djokovic, like Alcaraz, like, but they're all so good at.
Yeah.
Those things don't come as naturally to him. Like he's not the best athlete, but he's one of the best ball strikers, forehand, backhand, and serve. And his condition is so good.
I feel like he's an improved version of John Isner in a way.
Oh, yeah, much so, because his game is much more complete and he really hugs the baseline and he's competent on both wings. His backhand is, like elite, like one of the best in the world. And he can change directions on it. And obviously the forehand is like even bigger of a weapon than it used to be. His backhand, I always thought the ball striking was always really good.
Yeah, I think the forehand, one of the greatest things about it is obviously he can put it anywhere. And he can disguise a shot so well. Like he can throw in a drop shot. That was one of the shots in the highlights that they put in up, that he made an approach running around his backhand. And I was convinced he was going to hit it. Yeah. And I was convinced he was going to hit it inside out, and he hit it inside in. And I was just impressed, because like that's a good skill to have, like to disguise your shot. Like you don't really want to be calling like the direction you're going to go to with your body, and some players are good at detecting those things, right?
So it's a good idea to do it, especially when you have your opponent like push behind the baseline, because like they're expecting to like defend and get back to the middle and like cover the cross court or the down the line. But if you throw in the drop shot, that just gives them like another thing to worry about.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, drop shots are, and he's got good feel as well. It's pretty complete, as you said. Like I feel like if he can compensate for his movement,
and his net game is not that good, like his volleys and stuff. But probably the two areas are like the net game and the just naturally defensively. But I think he's gonna. Like he might not win another Masters 1000, but I think he can definitely have another top 10 season.
Yeah. I think he might, if the conditions are right, maybe he can pull off like a Cincinnati win.
Yeah, he'll probably need to stay healthy like
that too,
for a much longer period, because last year, even though he finished number 9, he still had so many injuries because he didn't play the entire clay season pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was, his foot was in a boot. Like I think after Wimbledon until the U.S. Open, which didn't help. Then he lost in the first round to Holt.
Yeah, he did suffer an injury, right? Indian Wells, so.
Oh yeah, and then Indian Wells, like he rolled his ankle, and then they got like 2 or 3 injections right before the match, numbed, so he couldn't feel the pain at all. But then that wore off, and then he was out for a lot of the clay season. So.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah.
So yeah, so that was and obviously Netflix covered that.
Yeah, so that was one of the good parts. I feel like because Fritz was able to win it, like Breakpoint kind of like it was a lot better in that sense that like you could see Taylor Fritz's win and like how he showed up against Nadal. Obviously, they didn't. I don't think they mentioned Nadal having a rib injury in that final.
No, they didn't. That would have been nice had they added that.
Yeah,
because like that was obviously a big part of the outcome.
Yeah,
and also. Because I get that they were only just trying to show like the next generation of players, and like trying not to mention really Djokovic or Nadal, but like that was a big part. Like that would have been nice to at least mention.
Yeah, just to add a bit to the context of it. Yeah, but all in all, like if we're just talking a little bit about Breakpoint, I enjoyed it because I just really like just be able to see more of players and like how they think like in the day to day and. I find that it's kind of always good to give like another perspective of the tour. Sometimes it's really easy for us on Twitter and like podcasters and whatnot, just to be like, oh, you should like be more confident or like believe more in your shots or like study more tactically and stuff. But like, I mean, I feel like he really did get to show like how much tougher it can be. Like if you're up there and just like in and out, and like it's just a very emotionally tiring to be a tennis player, I would say, or an athlete.
It really gives you a good sense of the psychology that goes on like behind the scenes and what these players are like thinking, because like even in that Fritz episode, like his entire team was basically telling him like, don't play. You're going to risk your entire career. What are you doing? This is one match. And he's like, no, I'm going to regret this for the rest of my life if I don't go on that court.
Yeah.
And so basically, you know, it just portrayed like that relentless side of him. And like, I don't think that was done for the cameras. I think that was actually pretty, that was a genuine part of the story. So yeah. I think that's, it's good that they got that in there. And yeah, like Breakpoint can only really just like add to the game, you know, it's not something that'll like hurt the sport or
do
any, like whatever it is, it's just another like additional thing, basically.
So, yeah, it's more content, so why not? Yeah. So,
and we need more content in tennis in terms of like the like covering the players and getting those interesting nuggets. Not necessarily more content in terms of more tennis, but more content in terms of like social media content, like for example.
Yeah, they'll come up like next year with like 5 different Masters 1000, like up to 14.
Yeah,
and then upgrading Indian Wells to a Grand Slam now.
And then I like how tennis also turns out these really cool stories, like the one with Mateo. You probably heard about the one with Mateo Pope. God, what's his name? The one who's a real estate developer.
Oh yeah, it's
Mateo Pukotic. Because he beat Jack Sock and he qualified for Delray Beach. But that story was nuts, because this guy has a day job 9 through 6, and he's in real estate development and like finance.
Yeah.
And like his backstory was wild, because he has an MBA from Harvard, and he was ranked in the like around 200 in 2016, and he played at Princeton. He was a really good player for 4 years at Princeton. And then like from 2014 to 2016, he got to 200 in the world. So you're thinking, okay, like now he can break through, like he's pretty good. But then he got all these injuries.
Yeah, he got a very serious stomach disease, I believe.
Yeah, like he had to get surgery for his stomach, and then he like never really recovered from that. And then that's when he thought, okay, I can get my business degree from Harvard. And then he started working 9 through 5, because then COVID hit and he could pretty much only play local events. And then now he just like does this like part-time, like, you know, he might not even like play like on the tour like that much, because he's so pretty much very successful in his normal life,
his normal career.
And like he trains with like 70-year-olds, like his boss.
Yeah, and he's also 33 years old. So, like, I mean, if he gives this a shot, it's going to last for, like, 3 years max.
Yeah. So, but that's pretty wild that you can go and beat Jack Sock.
Yeah.
In your first match and qualify. It's kind of like the Marcus Willis story at Wimbledon. Like,
yeah, that was a cool one as well.
Like, it's kind of one of those, like, fairy tales. It doesn't, like, last very long, but it's cool when it happens.
Yeah, it's always a feel good story, like when you hear those. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess that makes the round of it. Like, as you said, like, we're not going to go over the full draw of Dubai, the WTA 1000, but we will be following it. You can follow it with us and just like send us highlights and whatnot, like just making comments on Twitter at Tennis and Bagels. Tennis and Bagels official. Tennis and Bagels official. No.
Yeah, Tennis and Bagels official is our.
It's just the name of the account.
But you can follow us at Tennis and Bagels, I think.
Yeah, it's just Tennis and Bagels. And you can follow Vansh when he's going to share a bunch of crazy stats all the time at VanshB2K, and my horrible takes at Rolandberg Andre. And other things. And this week I shared a bunch of music. There's nothing to do with tennis. So if you want to follow me for like my personal stuff, that's there. But like
your disdain for guacamole is
My horrible take on guacamole. Yeah, let me know in my comments if you like guacamole or not, because I don't. And yeah. Well, I don't hate guacamole, by the way. I eat it, but I don't get the passion for it. It's just
okay, yeah.
Yeah. I kind of I like it. You know,
like, like for like parties and like Super Bowls.
Yeah.
Like for the Super Bowl or like a big like event or like like just a kind of nice snack or something.
But, yeah.
You know, yeah, I can. Yeah. I think we all have our food opinions that are different.
Yeah, the, the controversial food opinions.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure everyone has at least one. So.
Yeah. So, yeah. And Owen, who isn't here, maybe we're going to be able to chat soon, but you can also follow him at Tennis Nation. And we'll see you next time. So, see you later. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.